Chapter 22 had been left uncultivated for some years, and was now damp, and rank with juicy grass which sent up mists of pollen at a touch, and with tall blooming weeds emitting offensive smells, weeds whose red and yellow and purple hues formed a polychrome as dazzling as that of cultivated flowers. She went stealthily as a cat through this profusion of growth, gathering cuckoo spittle on her skirts, cracking snails that were underfoot, staining her hands with thistle milk and slug slime, and rubbing off upon her naked arms sticky blights which, though snow white on the apple tree trunks, made madder stains on her skin. Thus she drew quite near to Claire, still unobserved of him. Tess was conscious of neither time nor space. The exultation which he had described as being producible at will, by gazing at a star, came now without any determination of hers. She undulated upon the thin notes of the second-hand harp, and their harmonies passed like breezes through her, bringing tears into her eyes. The floating pollen seemed to be his notes made visible, and the dampness of the garden the weeping of the garden's sensibility. Though near nightfall, the rank-smelling wheat flowers glowed, as if they would not close for intentness, and the waves of color mixed with the waves of sound. The light which still shone was derived mainly from a large hole in the western bank of cloud. It was like a piece of day left behind by accident, dusk having closed in elsewhere. He concluded his plaintive melody, a very simple performance, demanding no great skill, and she waited, thinking another might be begun. But, tired of playing, he had desultorily come round the fence, and was rambling up behind her. Tess, her cheeks on fire, moved away furtively, as if hardly moving at all. Angel, however, saw her light summer gown, and he spoke, his low tones reaching her, though he was some distance off. "What makes you draw off in that way, Tess?" said he. "Are you afraid?" "Oh no, sir. Not of outdoor things, especially just now when the apple bluth is falling, and everything is so green. But you have your indoor fears, eh?" "Well, yes, sir." "What of?" "I couldn't quite say." "The milk turning sour?" "No." "Life in general?" "Yes, sir." "So have I, very often. This hobble of being alive is rather serious, don't you think so?" "It is now you put it that way. All the same, I shouldn't have expected a young girl like you to see it so just yet. How is it you do?" She maintained a hesitating silence. "Come, Tess, tell me in confidence." She thought that he meant what were the aspects of things to her, and replied shyly, "The trees have inquisitive eyes, haven't they? That is, seem as if they had. And the river says, 'Why do ye trouble me with your looks? ... and you seem to see numbers of tomorrows just all in a line, the first of them the biggest and clearest, the others getting smaller and smaller as they stand farther away, but they all seem very fierce, and cruel and as if they said, 'I'm coming. Beware of me. Beware of me.' But you, sir, can raise up dreams with your music, and drive all such horrid fancies away." He was surprised to find this young woman who, though but a milkmaid, had just that touch of rarity about her which might make her the envy of her housemates shaping such sad imaginings. She was expressing in her own native phrases, assisted a little by her sixth standard training, feelings which might almost have been called those of the age, the ache of modernism. The perception arrested him less, when he reflected that what are called advanced ideas are really in great part, but the latest fashion in definition a more accurate expression, by words in logy and ism, of sensations which men and women have vaguely grasped for centuries. Still, it was strange that they should have come to her, while yet so young. More than strange, it was impressive, interesting, pathetic. Not guessing the cause, there was nothing to remind him that experiences as to intensity, and not as to duration. Tess's passing corporeal blight had been her mental harvest. Tess, on her part, could not understand why a man of clerical family and good education, and above physical want, should look upon it as a mishap to be alive. For the unhappy pilgrim herself there was very good reason. But how could this admirable and poetic man ever have descended into the valley of humiliation, have felt with the man of us as she herself had felt 2 or 3 years ago? My soul chooseth strangling and death, rather than my life. I loathe it. I would not live alway. It was true that he was at present out of his class. But she knew that was only because, like Peter the Great in a shipwright's yard, he was studying what he wanted to know. He did not milk cows because he was obliged to milk cows, but because he was learning to be a rich and prosperous dairyman, landowner, agriculturist, and breeder of cattle. He would become an American or Australian Abraham, commanding like a monarch his flocks and his herds, his spotted and his ring straight, his men servants and his maids. At times, nevertheless, it did seem unaccountable to her that a decidedly bookish, musical, thinking young man should have chosen deliberately to be a farmer and not a clergyman, like his father and brothers. Thus, neither having the clue to the other's secret, they were respectively puzzled at what each revealed, and awaited new knowledge of each other's character and mood without attempting to pry into each other's history. Every day, every hour, brought to him one more little stroke of her nature, and to her one more of his. Tess was trying to lead a repressed life, but she little divined the strength of her own vitality. At first Tess seemed to regard Angel Clare as an intelligence, rather than as a man. As such she compared him with herself, and at every discovery of the abundance of his illuminations, and the unmeasurable, and the inaltitude of his, she became quite dejected, disheartened from all further effort on her own part whatever. He observed her dejection one day, when he had casually mentioned something to her about pastoral life in ancient Greece. She was gathering the buds called lords and ladies from the bank while he spoke. "Why do you look so weebigan all of a sudden?" he asked. "Oh, 'tis only about my own self," she said, with a frail laugh of sadness, fitfully beginning to peel lady meanwhile. "Ust a sense of what might have been with me. My life looks as if it had been wasted for want of chances. When I see what you know, what you have read, and seen, and thought, I feel what a nothing I am. I'm like the poor Queen of Sheba who lived in the Bible. There is no more spirit in me." "Bless my soul, don't go troubling about that. Why," he said with some enthusiasm, "I should be only too glad, my dear Tess, to help you to anything in the way of history, or any line of reading you would like to take up." "It is a lady again," interrupted she, holding out the bud as he had peeled. "What? I meant that there are always more ladies than lords, when you come to peel them." "Never mind about the lords and ladies. Would you like to take up any course of study history, for example? Sometimes I feel I don't want to know anything more about it than I know already." "Why not?" "Because what's the use of learning that I am one of a long row only finding out that there is set down in some old book somebody just like me, and to know that I shall only act her part, making me sad, that's all. The best is not to remember that your nature and your past doings have been just like thousands and thousands, and that your coming life and doings LL be like thousands and thousands." "What, really, then, you don't want to learn anything?" "I shouldn't mind learning why the sun do shine on the just and the unjust alike," she answered, with a slight quaver in her voice. "But that's what books will not tell me. T.S. Fie for such bitterness." Of course he spoke with a conventional sense of duty only, for that sort of wondering had not been unknown to himself in bygone days. And as he looked at the unpracticed mouth and lips, he thought that such a daughter of the soil could only have caught up the sentiment by rote. She went on peeling the lords and ladies till Claire, regarding for a moment the wave-like curl of her lashes as they dropped with her bent gaze on her soft cheek, lingeringly went away. When he was gone she stood a while, thoughtfully peeling the last bud. And then, awakening from her reverie, flung it and all the crowd of floral nobility impatiently on the ground, in an ebullition of displeasure with herself for her niaiseries, and with a quickening warmth in her heart of hearts. How stupid he must think her! In an access of hunger for his good opinion she bethought herself, of what she had latterly endeavored to forget, so unpleasant had been its issues, the identity of her family with that of the knightly d'Urbervilles. Barren a tribute as it was, disastrous as its discovery had been in many ways to her, perhaps Mr. Clare, as a gentleman and a student of history, would respect her sufficiently to forget her childish conduct with the lords and ladies, if he knew that those perbic marble and alabaster people in Kingsbere Church really represented her own lineal forefathers, that she was no spurious d'Urberville, compounded of money and ambition like those at Trantridge, but true d'Urberville to the bone. But, before venturing to make the revelation, dubious Tess indirectly sounded the dairyman as to its possible effect upon Mr. Clare, by asking the former if Mr. Clare had any great respect for old county families when they had lost all their money and land. Mr. Clare, said the dairyman emphatically, is one of the most rebellious drossums you ever knowed, not a bit like the rest of his family. And if there's one thing that he do hate more than another, 'tis the notion of what's called a old family. He says that it stands to reason that old families have done their spurt of work in past days and can't have anything left in them now. There's the Billets and the Drenkards, and the Greys and the Street Quintons, and the Hardys and the Goulds, who used to own the lands for miles down this valley. You could buy them all up now for an old song amist. Why, our little Reddy Priddle here, you know, is one of the Paradells, the old family that used to own lots o' the lands out by King's Hintock, now owned by the Earl o' Wessex, afore even here his was heard of. Well, Mr. Clare found this out, and spoke quite scornful to the poor girl for days. Ah! Apostrophe, he says to her, you'll never make a good dairymaid. All your skill was used up ages ago in Palestine, and you must lie fallow for 1,000 years, to get strength for more deeds. Apostrophe, apostrophe, a boy came here t'other day asking for a job, and said his name was Matt, and when we asked him his surname he said he'd never heard that it had any surname, and when we asked why, he said he supposed his folks hadn't been established long enough. Ah, you're the very boy I want. Apostrophe, apostrophe, says Mr. Clare, jumping up and shaking hands wyin', I've great hopes of you. Apostrophe, and gave him half a crown. Oh no, he can't stomach old families. Apostrophe, after hearing this caricature of Clare's opinion, poor Tess was glad that as he had not said a word in a weak moment about her family, even though it was so unusually old, almost to have gone round the circle and become a new one. Besides, another diary girl was as good as she, it seemed, in that respect. She held her tongue about the d'Urberville vault, the knight of the Conqueror whose name she bore. The insight afforded into Clare's character suggested to her that it was largely owing to her supposed untraditional newness that as he had won interest in his eyes. XX, the season developed and matured. Another year's installment of flowers, leaves, nightingales, thrushes, finches, and such ephemeral creatures took up their positions where only a year ago others had stood in their place, when these were nothing more than germs and inorganic particles. Rays from the sunrise drew forth. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.